So welcome again to Southeast City Church. We're so happy to have everyone here tonight. Our scripture reading for tonight is from Mark chapter 2, verse 23 to chapter 3, verse 6. On the Sabbath, he was going through the grain fields, and his disciples began to make their way, picking some heads of grain. The Pharisees said to him, "Look, why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" He said to them, "Have you never read what David and those who were with him did when he was in need and hungry? How he entered the house of God in the time of Abiathar, the high priest, and ate the sacred bread, which is not lawful for anyone to eat except the priests, and also gave some to his companions?" Then he told them, "The Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. Therefore the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath." Now he entered the synagogue again, and a man was there who had a paralyzed hand. In order to accuse him, they were watching him closely to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath. He told the man with the paralyzed hand, "Stand before us." Then he said to them, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do what is good or to do what is evil, to save life or to kill?" But they were silent. After looking around at them with anger and sorrow at the hardness of their hearts, he told the man, "Stretch out your hand." So he stretched it out, and his hand was restored. Immediately the Pharisees went out and started plotting with the Herodians against him, how they might destroy him.
Thanks, Tori. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Ooh. Okay. Lots of people here this evening. It must be nicer outside. This Sunday, I feel reinvigorated. There's hope. We're almost there, folks. We're almost there. Press on. After several weeks in our resilience series talking about some rather difficult topics, like community, committing to community, submitting to one another as brothers and sisters, and serving with everything we've got in the church and in the community, tonight we get to talk about rest. Do not rest during the sermon, however. Listen diligently. But tonight we're talking about the topic of Sabbath. And we're actually first introduced to the Sabbath in the Old Testament. So the Bible, as many of you know, but some of you might not, is made up of two testaments, the Old Testament and the New Testament. And the Old Testament is everything leading up to Jesus. And then the New Testament is the life and death and resurrection of Jesus and kind of the history and teachings of the early church. And so the Sabbath actually comes up in the Old Testament before Jesus. And it's one of the Ten Commandments. So we have this thing called the Mosaic Law. The people of Israel were God's chosen people, and God gave his laws to the nation of Israel, and those laws made up the Mosaic Law, made up the Mosaic Covenant, because they came through Moses, and this idea of Sabbath is one of those commandments, one of those Ten Commandments that are quite famous, even outside of Christianity and Judaism. And this is where it comes up. In a book called Exodus chapter 20, verses 8 to 11, God says, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. You are to labor 6 days and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You must not do any work, you, your son or daughter, your male or female slave, your livestock, or the foreigner who is within your gates. For the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and everything in them in 6 days. Then he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and declared it holy." So the Sabbath day was to be regarded as holy, set apart, distinguished from every other day. It was a distinct day. It was a special day. It was the Saturday, the seventh day of the week. And Shabbat is the Hebrew word from which we get Sabbath, actually means ceased, desist, and stop. Cease, desist, and stop. So 1 day a week for 24 hours from sunset the previous day till sunrise the following day, you are to cease, desist, and stop all activity. All activity. And it's interesting that in the commandment, it's for the entire nation of Israel. It's for everybody within the borders of Israel. I love what one commentator says. He says, the commandment specifically prohibits any Sabbath day shifting of laboring away from native Israelites to foreign workers, or from free Israelites to hired workers or servants, or from adults to children. Envisioned instead is an egalitarian work stoppage that benefits everyone and leaves everyone free and ready for worship and spiritual emphases. So it wasn't just that there was this select group of people that got to put their feet up on the Sabbath. Everybody got to put their feet up on the Sabbath, including the animals. You weren't supposed to work your animals. You weren't supposed to work your servants. You weren't supposed to work your children. No, everybody on the Sabbath for 24 hours gets to rest. Now, what kind of work was prohibited and what is meant by rest? Now, it's kind of interesting that as you read through the Old Testament doesn't give very many specifics on what you're not supposed to do on the Sabbath. It says that you can't kindle a fire, that all of your food should be made the night before, that you, your animals, can't carry heavy burdens, and you can't buy or sell. But that's about it. And interestingly, there's actually a lot of things that are allowed on the Sabbath. Marriage feasts, dedication feasts, visiting a man or woman of God, any work of the temple, the work of the priests and the Levites could be done on the Sabbath. Even sacrifices could be offered on the Sabbath. As a matter of fact, there were special Sabbath sacrifices that you were supposed to offer, two unblemished lambs and grain and drink offerings in addition to your regular offerings. So the Sabbath commandment doesn't prohibit any sort of exertion. You're not supposed to literally just sit on a couch and stare at a wall for 24 hours, as tempting as that might be for some of us. Rather, it seems that what's prohibited is duplicating on the Sabbath any of the usual labors of the other 6 days that can be stopped without harming somebody. So one guy that I was reading, he says, people and animals would still need to be fed, lactating animals would still need to be milked, priests would still need to work within the sanctuary, but to the extent possible, all workers were to receive a day of rest. And if you look at what's prohibited and you look at what's allowed, it seems that God's intention for the Sabbath was that it would be a day for the community to come together. It would be a day of feasting. It would be a day of celebrating. It would be a day of spending time with your family and with your friends and with your neighbors. It would be a chance to worship God together, to have focused time with God. It was meant to be taking a break from your usual routines and labors and doing something different, ceasing from the everyday activities and doing different activities, the things that would bring you closer to God and the things that would bring you closer to each other. Now, that's not to say, obviously, that worship, enjoyment of God, time with friends and family can't be done at all on any other day, but that those things were to be heightened on the Sabbath. Now, that sounds pretty nice. That sounds sweet. I love the idea of a 24-hour day of chilling with God and family and friends and feasting, love feasting, celebrating, you know, marriages and all this kind of stuff. That sounds great. But over time, the Sabbath became more strict. The religious leaders of Jesus' time, known as the Pharisees, they seemed to love rules. And they just heaped rules upon rules upon rules on the Sabbath. They asked the question, what does God mean by ceasing, desisting, stopping? And so they came up with dozens, if not hundreds, of things that you were not supposed to do on the Sabbath. And they imposed these things on the people. If you are a good Jewish person, you will not do any of these dozens, hundreds of things on the Sabbath. And the Sabbath ended up becoming this day full of rules. It ended up becoming very burdensome. It wasn't a day that you would get excited for. It was a day that you dreaded. Right? Because, oh no, that 24 hours is coming where I've got to keep track of all these things that I can't do. And it became burdensome. It got robbed of its joy. And interestingly, a lot of our Jewish neighbors today would keep many of these rules that the Pharisees had at Jesus' time. And they've even adapted for the way our modern world is. Leo was born at Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto. Our Leo was born at Mount Sinai in Toronto. And it's, I don't want to say a Jewish hospital. Lots of non-Jewish people go there. But there's, yeah, it has a Jewish heritage. And there's actually at the hospital a Sabbath elevator. You get on this elevator on the Sabbath, and it stops at every single floor so that you do not have to do the work of pushing a button to stop at a particular floor. And they call it a Sabbath elevator. So there's still this very strict observance to this day of all these rules and these rituals. And Jesus was very critical of it. He was very critical of it. In the passage that we just read, it suddenly got very quiet. In the passage, the children are intrigued by this message. in the passage that was read for us, Jesus says this: the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. The Pharisees are there wondering why Jesus' followers aren't keeping all of these rules. And Jesus reorients them to what the Sabbath was meant to be. He says the Sabbath was created to serve people. The Sabbath exists for the good and the flourishing of people. That's why God ordained it, but you guys have twisted it and warped it so that people are now serving the Sabbath instead. They spend their days serving its rules and serving its rituals. It was created for people, but you've twisted it so that people exist for the Sabbath. And Jesus said the Sabbath has become anti-human. And one example of that in Mark chapter 3, which was also read for us by Tori. In Mark chapter 3, Jesus is in the synagogue and there's a man with a shriveled hand. And Jesus wants to heal him. And the religious leaders are wondering, is he going to heal him on the Sabbath? Because you should never, ever, ever heal anybody on the Sabbath. Do it the other 6 days of the week, sure. But don't dare do it on the Sabbath. And Jesus says, look, is it better to do good or to do evil, to heal or to do harm on the Sabbath? And they don't answer him. They can't bring themselves to answer them. And he's angry with them. He's like, why in the world would you think that God would think it a bad thing for you to do good, for you to heal on the Sabbath? Of course, on the Sabbath of all days, you should heal and you should do good and you should help people. Now, here's the question that comes to mind at this point. Are we, as Christians, to observe the Sabbath today? I'm talking about Sabbath. Should we observe the Sabbath today? And by that I mean, should we set aside a literal 24-hour day as Christians where we all cease and desist, where we all stop doing work, and we all observe this holy set-apart day together? I don't believe that the Sabbath, as it was observed by Israel under the Old Covenant, is to be observed in the same way by us as Christians today. Now, not all Christians will agree with me on that. Many Christians are called Sabbatarians, right? They believe that Sunday is a holy, set-apart, distinct day. It's the Lord's Day, and you observe it the way Israel observed the Sabbath in the Old Covenant. That's one of the ways that I was raised. My parents would call themselves Sabbatarians. Many of my friends would call themselves Sabbatarians. But I don't think that how Israel did it is how the church is to do it today. And here's my argument. Now you can meet me at the back and debate me afterwards. But here's my argument. A Sabbath observance is commanded nowhere in the New Testament. Now, Jesus observes it as a good Jew, as one born under the law, but he does not seem to expect his followers or his disciples to observe it. In the passage that was read, Jesus actually claims to be Lord of the Sabbath. Now, we might read this as Jesus simply saying, look, don't tell my followers what they can and can't do. The Sabbath originates with me. I am the Lord, the King of the Sabbath. I get to decide what is acceptable and not acceptable on the Sabbath. I make the rules. It's a claim absolutely of deity. right? The Pharisees would have understood this. Oh my goodness, he's claiming to be God because God commanded the Sabbath and now Jesus is saying, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. I make the rules. He's claiming to be God. Absolutely, it's him claiming deity. But I don't think it's just that. I think that when Jesus says, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath, he's also saying, I'm the fulfillment of the Sabbath. I'm the one that the Sabbath points to. I am the Sabbath. Now, in case you're thinking I'm reading too much into one little line, Paul says this more directly in Colossians. In chapter 2, verses 13 to 17, he writes to these Christians in Colossae, and he says, you were dead in trespasses and in the uncircumcision of your flesh. You who were this way, he, Jesus, made you alive with him and forgave us all our trespasses. He erased the certificate of death with its obligations that was against us and opposed to us, and has taken it out of the way by nailing it to the cross. He disarmed the rulers and authorities and disgraced them publicly. He triumphed over them by him. Therefore, don't let anyone judge you in regard to food and drink, or in the matter of a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day. These are a shadow of what was to come, and the substance is the Messiah. So Paul is saying, don't let anyone judge you as unspiritual because you eat pork and you eat shellfish. Don't let anyone judge you as unspiritual because you don't observe Sabbath days or all of these festivals. He says, your salvation is in Jesus. You were sinners. You were dead to God. You didn't want anything to do with God. You were running from God. You were God's enemy. But Jesus stepped in, and Jesus has rescued you from eternal separation from God and restored you and reconnected you to God. You are now saved. You belong to God. He's your Father, you're his child, you're his forever, and he's yours forever, right? Jesus did all of that. Your salvation, your rescue, your deliverance is in Jesus. You are spiritual because of Jesus. All of your hope and your everything is in Jesus. So don't let anybody tell you that you've got to keep all of these rules to be right with God. No, Jesus has already made you fully and completely right with God. Your hope is in Jesus. It's not in keeping all of these other things. Are some of these things good? Sure, but your hope and your salvation is not in them. It's in Jesus. So he's saying, don't let anybody tell you that you're far from God because you don't do these things. Because of Jesus, if you've trusted in him, you are God's. You belong to him and he belongs to you. So in one sense, Paul is saying here, your salvation isn't about keeping Sabbath days. So don't let anybody tell you that you've got to keep this 24-hour period to belong to God. No, you don't. You belong to God because of Jesus. But then he says this interesting thing. Plus, not only that, all of these things, Sabbath days, the festivals, the food laws, all of these things were a shadow. They pointed to Jesus. They prepared us for Jesus. They taught us about who Jesus is and what Jesus was coming to do. And now Jesus has come. The substance of the shadow has arrived, and therefore the shadow itself can pass away. The food laws can pass away. Circumcision can pass away. The literal temple can pass away. The sacrifices, they pass away. And he would also say here, the Sabbath day. It can pass away. It pointed to Jesus. Jesus has come. You don't need the pointer anymore. You've got Jesus. Jesus is the fulfillment of the Sabbath. And so that's a little bit of my argument for why we don't need to observe a Sabbath in the same way anymore. What does it mean that Jesus is the fulfillment of it? I'll get to that in a second. One more question that might come to mind is not just should Christians do this, but well, isn't Sunday the Christian Sabbath? Isn't Sunday the new Christian Sabbath? Well, here's my point, my argument here. Christians started meeting on Sunday very early on in church history, and they did so to distinguish themselves from the religion of Judaism. They did it to honor Jesus's resurrection, which happened on a Sunday, but there's no evidence that I've come across, please tell me if there is, But there's no evidence that I've come across that the early Christians saw Sundays as the new Sabbath, that they believed we should do on Sunday what the Jewish people do on Saturday. As a matter of fact, many Christians worked on Sunday in the early centuries because they lived in cultures that didn't allow them to not work on Sunday. So they didn't cease and desist. They worked, but made sure to find time in the day to gather together as Christians to worship. And eventually Sunday came to be known as the Lord's Day, but that was really just to distinguish it as the day that Christians come together for corporate worship. They didn't mean for it to become a new Sabbath. Now, many Jewish Christians obviously wrestled with abandoning the Sabbath, just as they wrestled with abandoning food laws and abandoning circumcision and many other aspects of their former framework. And many of them believed that you needed those things in addition to faith in Jesus to be truly godly and truly spiritual. And this actually led to a lot of conflict in the early church, which you can read about in the book of Acts. Right? Jewish and Gentile, when the Gentiles especially started to convert to Jesus and started joining these churches that had been predominantly Jewish, all kinds of tensions arose. Now all of a sudden, uncircumcised Gentiles are coming into our midst and they eat bloody steak and shellfish and do all this stuff that we think you're not supposed to do. Like, how are we supposed to get along? And I find it interesting that Paul actually says this in Romans 14:5. He says, "One person considers one day more sacred than another, and another considers every day alike. Each of them should be fully convinced in their own mind." Paul's like, all right, there's all this tension, there's all this conflict. Here's the way to resolve it. Just respect each other. Some of you still want to observe the Sabbath. Some of you see every day as the same and no day is special or distinct. Just respect and get along with each other. It's going to be okay. In other words, what Paul is saying is he's actually validating the idea that you can have the opinion, the belief, that every day is the same day, that there is no special, distinct, distinguished day. I actually personally, and this might really upset some of you, but I actually personally don't like the Lord's Day, as if the other days don't belong to Him, right? Every day is the Lord's Day in my mind. I don't get to wake up on Monday morning and be like, this day does not belong to Jesus. And I know that's not what you're saying when you say the Lord's Day, right? But every day is the Lord's Day. Every day you surrender to Jesus and He's Lord. And so some of us might see days as special and some of us might see every day the same. And Paul says, let's respect each other. So that's my argument. You might like it, you might not. Talk to me afterwards. Don't email me. I don't like getting critical emails. Talk to me face to face. But how, I hope we can all agree that Jesus is the fulfillment of the Sabbath. Now, what does it mean that Jesus is the fulfillment of the Sabbath? It means that Jesus is rest for us. Jesus is God's rest for us. I was reading, I think it was in the Gospel of Mark. Yeah, the Gospel of Mark the other day, where Jesus is trying to get away from the crowds with his disciples, and the crowds keep finding him. And his followers are like, send them away, we want peace and solitude. And Jesus even tries to go out into the most desolate wilderness and the crowds still manage to find him and confront him. And at one point it says he looked at the crowd and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. He looked at the crowd and he loved them because what he saw were people who were lost, who were restless, who were frustrated, who were wandering, who were without meaning or identity or hope. They wanted someone to show them the way. They wanted someone to tell them who they were. And they didn't have that person, and they were just lost and wandering, and Jesus had compassion on them. And really, that's how God sees the human race. Wrestling, restless, frustrated, anxious, not really knowing who we are or what we're here for, just lost and wandering and trying to find our way. We've talked a lot about our current culture and the idea of absolute autonomy and radical individualism and freedom is the lack of all restraints and follow your feelings, right? Your feelings will tell you what is true and what is real, and look inside yourself to see who you are. And we're absorbing a lot of these things and believing a lot of these things. Let me tell you right now, I do not want to try and find myself by looking inward. When I look inward, I find a hot mess. An absolute hot mess when I look inward, right? All kinds of things just battling, and there's layers and complexities. I don't want to think, okay, I've got to find who I really am inside of myself. No. Because that's just going to change constantly. It's shifting sand. And yet people feel like, okay, I've got to create an identity for myself. I've got to create a meaning for myself. I've got to go wherever my feelings take me. It doesn't matter what people say around me. Like, I've got to make my world. I've got to discover myself for myself, right? That's what a lot of people are feeling and thinking. And when I look around, what I see is a lot of drivenness, a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear, a lot of depression, a lot of people just lost. And Jesus wants to enter into the midst of that and say our theme verse, come to me, Matthew 11:28, come to me all of you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Right? Jesus says, who you were made for is God. And I've come to reconnect you to God, to restore you to God, so that you can know the one that you were made for. And in knowing the one that you were made for, you can know what you were made for, and you can know who you really are. And that will give you rest. That will give you peace. That will satisfy your soul. Come to me, and I'll satisfy your deepest yearnings and longings and desires and give you wholeness. In that way, and probably in other ways, but certainly in that way, Jesus is our rest. He's God's rest for us. Now, there's an already and a not yet to this rest. Because even if you entrust yourself to Jesus and are restored to God and experience that rest that comes from God, we still live in a world that's as broken as us. We still live in a world that's as fallen as us, and there's still pain, and there's still death, and there's still darkness, and there's still evil, and these things war inside of us, and they war against us, and so we're not fully and completely at peace and rest yet. Our hearts are satisfied to some degree by Jesus, but there's still a yearning and a longing for an even deeper rest, and Jesus says he'll bring that when he comes again. That when he comes again to vanquish all evil and usher in the new heavens and new earth and set everything to right, that is when we will enter into the fullness of God's rest. So Jesus brings us God's rest to some degree now. He will bring us the fullness of God's rest later. He is the fulfillment of the Sabbath. And so I don't think we need to observe this 24-hour day to Sabbath. Rather, I think giving ourselves to Jesus is how we as Christians Sabbath. Now, here's the thing. Are there not principles that we can take from the Sabbath as it was in the Old Covenant? No, of course there are principles we can take. What is clear from the Sabbath in the Old Testament is that we need rest. As human beings, we need to cease and desist and stop. We need to step outside of our usual routines and patterns and behaviors. We need to set aside time for family, friends, neighbors, time for God. We need to do life-giving things, things we enjoy. We need to gather with other Christians for worship. We need to do good and to heal, to feast and to celebrate. We need to do the things that draw us closer to God and draw us closer to each other. Now, at this point, we might be thinking, feasting, celebrating, enjoying life, that doesn't sound very Christ-like, right? These things sound too hedonistic, like we're pleasure seekers. I came across this quote the other day from Dallas Willard, and it hit me hard. We dishonor God as much by fearing and avoiding pleasure as we do by dependence upon it or living for it. I'll say that again. We dishonor God as much by fearing and avoiding pleasure as we do by dependence upon it or living for it. We've seen what comes from being too obsessed with pleasure, right? Obsessed with the pleasure given to you by substances, you become an addict, you become an alcoholic. Obsessed with the pleasure given to you by intimacy, right? You get into all sorts of things, adultery, fornication, pornography. We've seen what comes from being too obsessed with pleasure. But then in Christian circles, what happens is the pendulum swings too far the other way. I mean, this is what we do as human beings. Oh, this was wrong. Wah! And right, and it's somewhere in the middle, right? We run from pleasure. And we think that any kind of pleasure is somehow un-Christ-like, that fun and joy are forbidden. And I just want to say that that's not true. God is a God of pleasure. God is a God of joy. And he's wired you for this. Where do you come alive? Do you come alive hiking in nature? Do you come alive through art, studying a nice painting, or reading a really good story, or watching a good story in a film, or reading really good poetry, or going out with your camera and taking pictures of what's around you, whether it be nature or urban landscapes? What makes you come alive? Is it sports that makes you come alive? Is it good food and drink that makes you come alive? What makes you tick? God would say it's okay if you do it within the parameters of the law of Christ to lean into those things. You dishonor God if those things replace God. You dishonor God if you become so obsessed with those things you forget about God, right? I play so much sports, I never gather with Christians for worship. I watch so much television, I never get together with my brothers and sisters to talk about Jesus, right? We dishonor God by becoming too obsessed with these things. But Dallas Willard would say, and I agree, we dishonor God by running from and avoiding these things. If art makes you come alive, don't run from it. If nature makes you come alive, don't run from it. Right? Don't run from these things. God's wired you in that way. We need this to stop the usual stuff and do the things that bring us close to God and to people, the things that make us feel alive, the things that are life-giving. And it's actually far better to do those things. That's really more of Sabbath resting than just vegging and turning your brain off, which I think a lot of us think is what rest is. We need this. Our culture is stressed out. I was reading an article in Corporate Wellness magazine the other day. Never heard of it before. But they were saying how so many people are stressed now because they work extremely long days. And you don't get to leave the office anymore. When you go home, all of your work comes with you. Your boss is still able to contact you anywhere at any time. There's a steady stream of texts that you need to answer from friends. You feel the pressure to update your friends and family on everything through social media. A lot of people, because of the lack of affordable housing, get pushed further and further away from their work. So now they've got 2 to 3 hours of commuting in addition to their extremely long days. And they open up their inbox and they've got hundreds of emails that they're expected to answer, and people are just stressed. We need to get away from it all. In a hectic, frantic, fast-paced culture, rest is an act of holy rebellion. It's an act of holy defiance. Rest is a declaration that you are not actually that important. One of the reasons I think we overwork is because we believe ourselves to be essential. If I'm not there, if I'm not doing this, it all falls apart. If I stop, everything stops. Guess what? God stopped. When we read about the Sabbath, it says that God rested on the seventh day. Now, obviously, God doesn't rest in the same way that you and I need to rest, but what it means is that he stopped from that particular creative work, and he took the time to look over it, to enjoy it, to celebrate it, and to declare it as good. If God stopped, you can stop. Jesus stopped. He took naps. He went to desolate places. He got away from the crowds. He spent time with his closest friends and not just with everybody else. He feasted. He went to people's homes. He sat at tables. He had meals. Jesus stopped. If Jesus stopped, we can stop. To rest is to accept that the only person for whom no rest is needed, the only person for whom that's true in the universe is God. God is God and you are not. Resting is an act of humility and dependence. Resting is a declaration that you have value even if you're not busy, that you don't have to be doing something to be significant. You're a human being, not a human doing. And lastly, rest is a dramatization of the gospel. When I rest, I am dramatizing the reality of my salvation, that I'm at rest with God and Jesus. In truth, there is no better way to rest than to rest in Jesus, in his finished work, that Jesus has done everything that's necessary for us to be accepted, to be loved, to be pleasing to God. In Jesus, we are enough. And I think as Christians, we need to be constantly reminding ourselves of that. And it's only when we do that that we can rest in any of the other ways. If I'm resting in Jesus, knowing that he's done everything that's necessary for me to be right with God, and in God's eyes, I'm loved and accepted and pleasing and all of these things. If I rest in that, then I won't see myself as essential at the church or at my job. I won't feel like I've got to work to have value and significance. I'll know that I already have it. And this is why I think rest is necessary for resilience. It might seem like the opposite, right? Rest doesn't lead to resilience. No, it does. Because our hearts are drawn away from Jesus when we think that what we're doing is more important than him, or we think that we can get value from what we're doing rather than value from him. Rest keeps us healthy. It keeps us going. It refocuses us. It gives us perspective. It helps us reprioritize. But most importantly, rest keeps us close to Jesus. And rest makes us resilient. So let's be a people who rest. Let's pray. Father, thank you. Thank you that you give us permission to rest. We need it, I think, a lot of us in the room. We feel guilty when we do it. But you made us to rest. And so, God, I pray that we would be a people who know that we're not essential, we're not that important, we're not you. I pray that we would be a people that know our value and significance does not come from doing. I pray that we would be a people who can cease and desist and stop for our health, for our thriving and flourishing, and really for your glory. So that we can display your gospel, the reality that Jesus did all the work that was necessary so we could rest. God, help us to do these things in defiance and rebellion in our culture. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.